So thank you, Lauren, for having me here, like giving you guys this lecture or this notes. So I'm going to tell you about convolutional neural networks. So let me tell you roughly what they are. So let me first remind you quickly the feed-forward neural network that you explored last week. So, and what's the difference between that one or the limitations, or if you want, well, not necessarily the limitation, but the characteristic of what those are and how these are different from the fully connected neural nets that you explored last week. Okay, so if you remember correctly, last week you had something like I don't know, layer L or activations A and layer L, and they were connected to activations in layer L plus one. And the key characteristic that they had was that they were fully connected, right? Like, meaning that every neuron in layer L was kind of like interacting with every other neuron in layer L plus one, right? So, and the idea is that depending on the nature of the data, this is probably too much, in the sense that, like, for instance, if you want to induce correlations between distant neurons, which may or may not be present in your data, then like what you do is you just connect all of them, okay? So that you ensure that these correlations are accounted for. But sometimes what you can do is exploit the spatial structure of the data in order to simplify, the structure of the neural net and the calculations and the training of these neural nets. Okay, so this is for the fully connected neural network. And so, for instance, in what happened is, like, for instance, if you have a two-dimensional image, like spin configurations of the Ising model in two dimensions, or like an image, like a real life image, like a cat or a dog or a digit that is handwritten. What you do with this type of neural networks when you start processing the data is you take that image, which is two dimensional, and then you flatten it into a vector, right? So you go from something that looks like, maybe I should write bigger, right? You go from something that looks like this, like a five or a digit, where like you have this two-dimensional structure, and then you transform it, you flatten it into a vector, right? Like, so for instance, you have, I don't know, suppose this is pixel, I don't know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, and so on, right? And then when you flatten it into a vector, then you bring this here, like 1, the second here, 2, 3, 4, 5. And notice that even though 4 is here, and it's not connected at all to pixel 5, they and like when you flatten the image, they end up near each other, right? Even though they're not even close, so they're not spatially close, right? So and then and so on, right? Like 6 through I don't know whatever number of pixels you have, and then that's how you that's how you flatten the image, and that's the input to this type of fully connected neural nets. So there's no spatial information at all once you do that, right? And then you start like connecting those inputs to all those neurons that you have, and then every input is fully connected to each neuron, right? And so if, for instance, during your learning task and during these calculations that you want to perform with the neural net, then all that information has to be retrieved by the training algorithm, okay? And sometimes this is okay, like when your data doesn't have any structure, but in here we have a very clear structure. It's two dimensions. There's somehow a local connectivity that you can exploit and so on. And like, for instance, we know that in an image, this pixel 1 is near pixel 5 and 6 and 2, not close to 4. Right, like so, we may want to exploit this depending on the learning task that you're trying to accomplish. Okay, so that's the idea that of the convolutional neural networks, that we want to exploit this dimensionality and this local connectivity in the learning. Right, like we want to exploit that. And this doesn't have to be spatial correlations. They can be also time correlations, right? Like, for instance, if you take a video, real-life video, like human-scale video, it's like a two-dimension space plus time, okay? And then, for instance, if you take a pixel in an image, I don't know, at time t equals zero, the next frame, which is, I think, milliseconds away from, or that's if you're on the frequency of a normal video. Like what happens at pixel I at times t equals to zero is going to be highly correlated with what happens at the same pixel I at times t plus 1 millisecond. Okay, yeah.
So basically, you kind of helping your neural network instead of letting it to figure out itself that those at some point neural network will figure out, right, that those they are correlated.
Right.
Kind of helping it and feeding that information.
Exactly. That's what we want, right? That instead of letting the fully connected neural net figure out all those correlations that are present in the data, we want to provide, if you want, an inductive bias or help them to giving the neural net some structure so that it makes it easier for the neural net to learn all those characteristics or those correlations, right? So yeah. Okay. So let me see. So how do we do this? How do we help the neural network figure out this? How do we enforce this? How do we exploit this structure that is present in the data already? Okay, so that we train faster, train better, and so on, depending on the situation. And this is also, like, let me just make a little comment. We do this all the time in physics too, right? Like, we exploit symmetries, we exploit a spatial structure when we write down answers for wave functions and so on. So it's kind of like a natural thing also for physicists to do. And so let me tell you how this is done. So what are the ingredients, right? So ingredients. So first we have something that we are going to call local fields. Second thing is weight sharing, and then this is optional, but some people use it a lot, and it's called pooling. So I'm going to say optional. This is to say that the most important aspects of the convolutional neural networks are local receptive fields and weight sharing. So let me, and this is kind of like, optional. So let me go into what each of these three are, or what they mean. All right, let me get started with the local receptive fields. So here it is where we start. So first, let me write it down. So local receptive fields. So keep the So first thing is keep the dimensional structure of the data intact. Okay, so if we start with an image, then we leave the image. We want to process it as an image. If we have video, it is a three-dimensional thing. If we have a two-dimensional spin configurations of the Ising model, then they're two-dimensional. If they're three-dimensional, then we leave them three-dimensional, and so on. Okay, so that's the first thing. So we're going to use the image as it is, or the 3D configuration as it is. And then introduce a local receptive field. If you unpatches patches of the image, or image, or one at a time. Okay, so let me just break this down, like with a plot. Okay, so let's say we have two-dimensional configurations of the Ising model, okay? So very small configuration. So let's say four by four. Right, something like that. And there are spins, for instance, up or down, or plus or minus one. And so what are these local receptive fields? Okay, so I'm going to use the same notation that Lauren introduced last week, where lines mean they mean weights or connections, and this mean neurons or inputs or vectors, right? Or numbers. So, and then local receptive field is when you just take patches of the image which are locally connected. And then you process them through like the same idea, right? Like with with the set of weights, okay? And then here is this again, some nonlinear activation, and that's like if you want like your new, I don't know, like I'm going to call this AL, like the whole image, right? Like the whole configuration. So if we're at the beginning of the neural net, the input, this is L is equal to zero, right? Is that zero? Okay, so that's the zeroth layer, and these are just spin configurations, up or down, right? And then what you do is, when you apply these local receptive fields, is you take groups of neurons or inputs which are locally or spatially connected to each other, like naturally, for instance, in 2D, we have this type of connectivity, and then you take weights, and then you multiply those weights by this four, in this case, spins or A's or variables, and then you combine them and you process them through a nonlinearity. Okay, same as like you were doing last week with the fully connected neural network. So this weight, these lines here mean the same thing here. Right, and then the idea is that instead of like processing the entire image or the entire configuration, you process the configuration one patch at a time, and this patch is defined locally, like according to the connectivity of your image or your spin configuration and so on. And here I introduce like a square or a 2x2 filter, but they can be any size, right? Like they could be, for instance, 3 by 3 or 3 by 2 and so on.
The diagonal, for example, right? Like in case my data has some crazy connection that the diagonals mean something, then you can also define like that 4 neurons, 4 data points that are diagonally, yeah.
You could define a filter like that. Yes, you can define a filter like that. Yes, so this is, I guess, depending on the nature of the data, you could define this as like the most natural thing. For instance, if you break, if you have a system where you break symmetry, like a nematic system in condensed matter, then you can have this type of order where it may make sense, mm-hmm. right? So, but in machine learning, people traditionally do this type of like squares and rectangles, but you could define, for instance, crosses and like where, so it's really data dependent. But you can also think about this as a filter, which is this with zero weights in this 4 spins.
Yeah, and it, in any amount of dimensions. Like here, it's like 2-dimensional, but if my my data is n-dimensional and I need to do that.
Yeah, you can have like little hypercubes and so on. So convolutions are defined in any dimension, mm-hmm. right? So you can define your kernels. I'm going to be more precise in a little bit, but you can define these kernels of the convolution in any dimension. Okay. So, okay, so good. So we had, so we had this red. So we had this 4 spins, which were processed through this set of weights. And but then, like, how do we go ahead and process the entire image, right? Or the entire configuration? So what the idea is that what you do is you bring this filter or this set of or this local receptive field, and then you bring in first. You first bring it here, this 2 by 2 region, and then you do the processing. You get, let me see how to draw this. So let me try again. So you come here to this region, you do this matrix multiplication or like this same type of like process that you saw last week. I'm going to be more precise in a little bit, but let me just speak about it. You come here, you do this calculation, and you get your AL plus 1 image. So here you get, I don't know, a number. Then you come here, you do the same, you get one more. Then you come here, you get one more. Then back here, you get this. And here, this, and here, this, then here, and then you get that, okay? And each, let me see if I can connect one. I don't know, this. And so, okay. And you do that like for every single patch in the image, right? So that's the idea, like that's how you, process or how you use these local receptive fields to process a two-dimensional image while retaining the local structure of the data and the dimensionality. Okay, so here you didn't change dimensionality when you went from AL to AL plus 1. Right, so that's the idea, and that's how we do this type of operations, right? So I didn't explain many things, so let me explain a few things. And so the first one I mentioned was the size of the map, which I picked to be 2 by 2, okay? But it can be anything. It can be, for instance, 3 by 3, and then you will have something which is different than this. Basically, if you start with 3 by 3, then you get this. Then you move one, you get this one. Then you come here, you get another one. And then finally here, and you get there. So you reduce the size of the of your A L plus one feature map if you do it on a bigger filter. Okay, so that I explained. I didn't explain the idea. So there are several things. So one is size of the map or the filter. There's also something called stride, which in like in traditional definition of the convolution is not there, but this is something that machine learning people like and use. It is the fact that you can, so I started doing this, right? Like a filter, or a 2x2 filter, I started here and then I moved here. But that doesn't have to be the case. You can start here and then move here and then here and then here, right? And that's what people call stride, okay? It's when you jump in steps which are bigger than just one. All right, so stride is kind of like as you move or slide. Take bigger jumps. Okay, so it doesn't have to be here, here, here. You just do it here, 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 here. Okay, and this the size of the stride affects the size of the following feature map. Okay, same as we did with the size of the filter. Okay, so and people use this because sometimes the information that you have here, when you have a lot of correlation, doesn't change, right? Like for instance, if this spin is, like for instance, in the icing model at very low temperature, the information that you have here is probably very similar to what you have here because the spins are mostly polarized, okay? So then doing this, like having a larger stride only helps you, right? Like because as you move, your information flow through the neural network, what you do is you're simplifying the computational task at each layer, okay? So this, so size of the filter as you grow, it reduces the size of the representation and it helps you have a more compact neural network. Same happens when you have a larger stride, okay? That as the stride is bigger, then your configuration decreases in size and your computational task is easier, right? And you somehow lose information or correlations, but some of this information may or may not be relevant, okay? So it's really data dependent and so you have to be careful about how you use those strides. Okay, so that's one thing. There's also a different idea, it's called padding, okay? And what is padding, right? Like, so the idea is that sometimes we want to retain the size of the image as we do this type of processing. But as we saw, when we went from this image to the next one, or this configuration, or this feature map A to the A L plus one, we reduce the size of the configuration, right? Like we went from 4x4 to 3x3, even when we had stride one, right? So the idea is that the idea of padding is that you can try to retain the size of the configuration as you go, and that is done by like by adding zeros. So these are not balls, but let me see. In here. So basically you're adding a big bunch of zeros.
I have a question.
Sure.
Because I think when we did the analysis for the icing model, when we calculated it like by hands, I thought when we move to the side, we make the new kind of set of four by adding two other, like, you know, it's as if it's on the big donut, you know, not as if.
Yeah, yeah. So that's a great question.
You won't lose the size,
right? Like, so in that case, so let me repeat the question. Is that when you're starting, for instance, the Ising model on a torus, then there's no boundary in the image. You're on a torus, and then what you can do is you can apply this boundary condition to the convolution, okay? Where, like, for instance, this filter is fine and so on, but when you come here, you know that once you go here, this is going to be the same as this, and this one is going to be the same as this one. And then, so what you can do is you just bring it here, and then you replace those two spins by those two. So you, and then in that case, you don't reduce the size of the representation as you go. Okay, so that's right. That's that's a good observation. So the idea of padding is introduced when you have open boundary conditions and you want to retain the size of the configuration. And then if you add these zeros, then you just slide the filter as usual, and then just basically you do the same when you get here. It's just that you add a big bunch of zeros. So that's the idea of padding. And you can do it or not. It depends on your task, right? Okay, let me go ahead with, so this is, I mean, I hope this is a little bit clear. Is that fine? It's pretty easy, but just if you have questions, we can take them. If not, then let me go ahead with the shared weights and biases. So let me just tell you right away what it is. So shared weights and biases. So when I mentioned, you know, I was explaining all this, like moving around the image and so on, I didn't tell you whether I was using which weights when I was doing these operations, right? So it could have been that when I was doing a calculation on this group of neurons or configurations, I was using a set of weights W. And then when I moved here, I was using a different set, okay? But that doesn't, well, that depending on this, what you want, that may or may not be good. But the idea of shared weights is that when you do that, then you retain the weights. The same weights that you use here, you use here, here, and here, and here, and here, okay? Meaning that what you're doing is kind of like performing a local analysis of your configuration with a set of weights that is fixed. Okay, so let me write that down. So shared, this is important. And bias. So it's exactly that. So this local receptive field. So it's moved data. And the numerical values of the filters remain the same. All right, so let me just give you one example. Suppose you you want to compute the energy of the Ising configuration. So how do you do it? Like, you have a Hamiltonian, right, that has this form, I don't know, like J, sigma I, sigma J, I and J. So there's only one parameter in this Hamiltonian, right? And all you do is you go and check every bond whether the spins are pointing in the same direction or in the opposite, okay? But the point is, or the connection is here, there's a shared weight on the on the Hamiltonian. So this is for the like the simplest Ising model, right? Like this translational invariant. So this J is always the same. And when you want to compute the energy, you just come here and you say, okay, are the spins pointing in the same direction or on the opposite? And then good. So then you know what this is. You come here, you just don't use a different J, you use always the same J. Okay. So it's kind of like the same idea. This is the shared weights that you come, you bring those filters here, you use them, and when you move here, you don't change them. It's like the same idea. You have all the same J when you're computing the energy. It's just that in this case, it's a little just more complicated. You're doing a convolution instead of just computing this product over the two spins, right? So finally, yeah, this is going to be the only equation that I'm going to write. I'm going to describe all these words that I was explaining, or a fraction of these words, into one equation, meaning what's the relation between AL and this AL plus 1, all right? Basically telling you what's this convolution operation between layer L and layer AL plus 1. Right, and it contains all this information. It contains this local receptive fields and the shared weights and biases that I was just discussing. And then in the equation, you will see a fraction of what I said. Okay. Okay. Right. So. I'm going to do it for a two-dimensional configuration, but you can apply the same idea or same type of expression for higher dimensional data sets or data structures. So this is, okay, so L plus one. Here, Lauren, you can probably help me with the, just like with the notation, but. Okay. Okay, this is F. All right, so what is going on? So here we have, so I introduce a big, like a many more indices, right? So these are like, so this is your, sorry, let me start with, yeah, so this is your input feature map A. At layer L, so it's a two-dimensional object. But I add so in here you have the y coordinate. Okay, so this is kind of like how the index pointing along this direction. Then we have the x coordinate, which tells you where along this dimension you are. And finally, I had this L. Okay. And this L I didn't explain before, just because I wanted to simplify the discussion. But L can be many things. So L can be, for instance, in an image, like in a color image, you have three channels, right? Like you have the red, the green, and the blue, RGB, right? Like, so you can have, typically, when you see a color image, what you're seeing is like a combination of three images in different colors, okay? Or like each pixel has three different intensities, right? Corresponding to three different colors. So that's this L. So which of the three, okay? The three channels you're looking at. So that can be for image, But in physics, we also have, or in condensed matter, we have sublattices, right? Like, for instance, when you, let me see if I can draw one lattice with a sublattice. So can you give me one example of a lattice with a sublattice? Or for instance, so this one is good because you're going to be using it, I think, soon. So the toric code or the Ising gauge theory, it has, so it's defined on a lattice where the spins are located at the bonds of the lattice, okay? So these are the, where you locate the spins, all right? And so this is, so how do you describe this? You describe this as the square lattice with two sublattices, right? Like, so if you want, these are, so these are this indices in the square lattice, but then you have two different sublattices. One, so two per each point in the square lattice. Okay. So, so how do you describe that? That's kind of like this L index is. So this is the purpose of this index, right? Like when you have, like at least in condensed matter or in this like statistical mechanics models, right? Like when you have a simple lattice like the square one, but you have an internal structure on each site, okay? And in this case, we have two. So this is kind of like your RGB. So site one, and then you have spin A and spin B, right? So in this case, we don't have RGB, we have RG, not randomization group, but just two colors, or spin A and spin B. Okay, so so this is why I introduced this this notation. A different example is, for instance, this one's also two, but so the honeycomb lattice. So this one is like a triangular lattice with two. So A and B, and then you repeat. Let me just do it with white. So A, B, A, B, A, B, A, B, and then the A's are located on the vertices of a triangular lattice. Right, and so on, but then you have two sublattices A and B. Okay, so and the triangular lattice can be understood as a square lattice, okay, with one extra bond, and so on. So you can use this this index L when you're trying to deal with lattices which have some sublattice structure in it. Okay. So that's why I introduced this new index L, right? So that's the description of the input, which has one more element. Then we have the filter K, which is, you slide along the Y direction. So let me see what I wrote. So this is, again, kind of like sliding along Y. This is the same sliding along X. And then this is, we have a filter for each of the sublattices in the image, or the different colors sublattices in the spin configuration, or colors in the image. So you have also an index for which color or which channel or sublattice, right? Okay, and then finally we have an output channel. Okay, because the images that we're going to be producing, so this is AL. So this set of configurations that we're going to produce may or may not have different colors or different sublattice structure and so on. Okay, so we add them a color or a sublattice too, okay? So this is basically the description of or the data structures that we use when you do this type of convolution operators. And then what we do is we go ahead, we sit down at each point X and Y. And then we multiply this vicinity by this kernel M, this kernel K, sorry. Right? And then finally we add a bias B, which is dependent on the channel, just the channel. So that's after the convolution. So this part is the what people call convolution. Or I think let's say this is the convolution part, and then this bias, which is channel dependent, and then finally a nonlinearity. Okay, so this F, I think Lauren discussed it already. So it can be sigmoid or tan H, hyperbolic tangent, or ReLU. Rectify linear units and so on, and that's it. Okay, so this is the description of the or what happens in a convolutional layer of a convolutional neural net.
Here, biases and weights are shared.
They are shared, right? Like.
And if I don't want to do the shared biases and weights, then there will be different formulas.
If you don't want to do the sharing, then you have to make K.
For each
x and y,
yes.
Right. So meaning that when you come here, you define a set of weights, and if you don't want to share them, then they have to depend on whether you're located here or here or here.
So for example, when I perceive images, I mostly want to concentrate on the pixels that are darker, of course, right? Because that's they define the shape of my number. So it doesn't mean that I need to apply different weights and biases for like, you know, that kind of darker groups of pixels or not.
So it's a little bit more complicated, but like I can tell you roughly, and that was one of my examples. So what do these filters look like, okay, when you do training? Okay. So I can tell you, and then we can discuss a little more about your question, okay?
Sure.
I think it's related. So what happens when, so why are these, things useful, and what do they detect once you train the once you train a neural net which has this type of structure? Should probably use the technology, right? Already erased, but so yeah. So so the idea is that these filters learn to detect characteristics everywhere in the image, and those characteristics should be useful. And what you do is you just go ahead with the sliding of the filters, and you're looking for these patterns that the filters learn. Okay, and so let me just give you a trivial, like some cartoon idea of what they do, but this is not how they work. But what happens is, you can imagine that you're trying to, detect a dog or a cat, okay? And then so you can imagine that these filters detect, for instance, eyes, like your eyes or the cat's eyes. And then so you have a filter, let's say a 4x4 or 5x5, like however big those eyes are, and then they detect eyes, okay? So then when you're going around the image, and then you find an eye, and then you say, okay, I detected an eye, then presumably you go here, then you detect the other one, okay? But that doesn't tell you this is a dog, okay? It may or may not be, or either, right? So, and then you have a filter for the nose and so on, because as I said, you have different ones, K. So some of them will detect eyes, some of them will detect ears, some of them will detect big ears, some of them would, like, this is a cartoon of what they do. So I'm not telling you something that happens, but kind of like to motivate the idea. But more realistically, what happens in the like a first convolutional layers of computer vision architectures is they detect edges, okay? Like, for instance, this. Like, in here you have white and here you have black. And I don't know, like, once you slide that, then you start detecting, just edges in an image, okay? But edges come in different flavors, if you want. So different filters detect different edges. So this is one edge, but another one could be one which is horizontal, okay? Or it doesn't have to be white and black. It can be this way, right? Where the edges, like where the white is just below the black. And then they come in different directions, right? And so on, okay? And so the idea is that as you train this first layer of your convolutional neural network, well, you train the entire thing, but when you train them, that this is kind of like what you see for computer vision problems, that this first thing that what this thing is first doing is just detecting the edges in the image. And then what happens is, like, you take those edges and then you start creating shapes.
So you do convolution network, and then your next level is also convolution level.
That's right. So typically people start with a set of convolutional layers, and then at the end you learn like all this like high level representation of the image, and then they put a fully connected layer that processes this high level features to make a classification.
Can I ask a quick question about the shared weights and biases?
Sure.
So the idea of that is that your system has some kind of translational symmetry, right?
Right.
But like if you have a photo or a lattice, like it ends at some point, it has an edge, right?
Yeah.
So do people like fix that by like having the field at the very end have like variable weights and biases or something?
No, they just either do padding or no padding. That's all they do, but the weights are shared. They don't, ultimately what you care about, like when you're doing image processing, is whether you're detecting features or not, and that you detect them everywhere in the image. Because for instance, if you're detecting eyes, like they're gonna appear here and here for an image, but let's say this is the image, but they can also appear somewhere here.
Yeah, but I mean, if you're studying condensed matter systems, then don't weird things happen at the very edges?
Yeah, so, but if you're doing condensed matter, then you do this thing that we mentioned before, that you still do the sharing, but you usually do studies on a torus, and then you just basically don't have that problem. You just keep the translational invariance. When you hit the edge, yeah, then basically, if you're applying a filter here, then you have, you know that the neighbors of these spins here are here.
I see.
Right, and then so what you do is you bring them here and then do the the operation with the same shared weights and biases.
Okay, but sometimes you're interested in looking at systems that are not, don't have closed boundary conditions.
Yeah, so then you do, if you're interested and you still want to use this type of ideas, then you don't use translational invariance, right? Like because there's the physical system doesn't have it.
Okay.
So you only can use, I don't know, for instance, mirror image symmetry. So then you can use, but typically if your system doesn't have a symmetry, then you don't want to, you don't necessarily want to use it.
But like, I don't know, near the center, you expect some kind of translational symmetry, right? It's only when you move towards the edges that you expect it to be.
You, that, but that's not an exact symmetry, okay? You may say, okay, near the center, it's roughly translational invariant, but it really isn't, right? So you may want, so you can do whatever you want, right? Basically, no one will punish you for using translational invariance in your convolutional neural net when in reality your system doesn't have the symmetry. But is it the most reasonable thing to do or not?
So if you have an eye on the very left of the photo, or will the convolutional neural network look for the other eye on the right side of the photo?
Like here?
Yeah.
Well, no, right? Like, because you, so depending on how you define the operation and your data set, right? Like, because the what you learn is just, like you have to have data where one eye is here and one eye is here. Like for you to learn that thing, right? Like, but I don't think you have pictures with periodic boundary conditions.
I see.
I don't see it. I haven't seen them before.
I see.
Or maybe you have. Have you seen? I don't think there are cameras with like where pictures define on the torus.
There's like the 360 cameras that let you see the room.
True, but those are. That's not torus, right?
The sphere.
You also can have in your data, like say, cat like this and cat like this, then it will be one eye, and then you can teach your network. One eye is also fine.
Anyway, good question. So I think we're almost done. I had only one more thing to add, which is the pooling. Maybe I can spend 3 minutes on the pooling. So just very quickly, there's one more ingredient which people use, or it's called pooling. And then what the pooling does is to simplify or to summarize your feature maps, your A, L plus one, like this big tensor, okay? So, and then the idea is, so suppose you have again this 4x4, And suppose that there's a lot of correlation in the image or in the configuration, meaning that, for instance, you have that this takes value 1, and this one 1, and 1, and here finally you have a 0 or a 0.5, and so on. And the same is here, here, here. So that if you take a patch, that the amount of information that you have is pretty redundant, right? And this happens, for instance, again, coming back to the Ising model at low temperature, right? Like it's pretty redundant. So what you can do is you can come and process again groups of neurons with a pooling operation, okay? And then so what are the different pooling operations? So let me see. So suppose you have, I'm going to do again the 2x2 pooling. So 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1. You end up with with a 3x3 configuration or feature map. So let me define what this pooling is. So each of this uh, local features are defined this way. So one of the possibilities is max of A1, A4. Okay? So you take, so I'm calling A1 through 4. So I changed the notation with respect to that, but like I'm calling this 1, 2, 3, 4, or any of this connected variables. And then what you do is you just take the max of the of all of them. So that's one of the pooling operations. There's also average pooling, where you replace this by A1 plus A2 plus A3 plus A4. So that's also one simplification or one summary, like a summary of what's going on in the vicinity of a few variables. You can also do a majority rule. This works for discrete variables. And what it does is, like, you have, suppose you have a set of discrete variables and they, they're plus, 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 and then minus. Or 1, 1, 1, and 0. Then you take the, which one is like the majority, right? Like, so you take a 1.
Is that correct that then you do that instead of applying this complicated formula?
No, so they're not something that you do one or the other. Like, you typically do this. You always do it. And then some people would like to do this when there's a lot of correlation or redundancy in the outcome of this type of operation.
Yeah. Yeah, and so I just don't understand one thing. So, what other, like, what you do first and what you do next, or because so, I don't understand how you can do them.
Right. So typically you do this first, and then on the on this you do the pooling.
So imagine I had 4 and 4 structure originally, and then I apply this with the size of my map. 2 by 2, so I end up with 3 by 3.
Right.
And then I do pooling out of that 3 by 3, and I end up with 2 by 2.
Yeah, exactly.
Why not pooling first and this then?
Oh, so there's no, okay, so I don't know. There's no, I think that this is very...
Empirical observation.
Yeah, it's an empirical thing that doing this helps when there's a correlation. Right? Okay. But if you... So usually, look, I didn't emphasize it, but when you do this, you lose information, right? Like you cannot extract A1, A2, A3, and A4 out of the max operation or the average and so on. So you do this when you have a lot of redundancy and you want to keep like the least amount of information. And so that's, yeah, so it's an empirical observation and they use it and sometimes it helps. Kind of like because it reduces the amount of information and then it makes the training faster. Because
basically doing the dimensional reduction, like linear dimensional reduction of the...
Yeah, on groups of neurons.
Okay, so yeah. You remove the noise.
Yeah, kind of like a little information bottleneck where you make only, when you allow to pass only what you need.
What is really relevant for...
For the learning task at the under consideration, right? Okay, so this is it. If you have questions, let me know. And we'll see you tomorrow, I guess.
So what about the majority and max? Don't seem to be very different.
Because
or so if you have like... They don't seem to be smooth.
They're not smooth, but there are smooth definitions.
You can define it.
You can define...
About propagation.
Soft. So the soft max is, you can define a soft majority rule. Average is smooth and so on. But.